My name is Nick Byrne. I'm the UK director of the Confucius Institute for Business London, and I'd like to point out the China director, Professor Li Shengguo from Tsinghua University, is also hosting the event tonight, and also, I should say, our associate director of the Confucius Institute for Business London, Dr. Ken Deck, is here. So we have the full complement of directors and associate directors here. It is my pleasure to welcome Charles Haswell from HSBC tonight. I've known Charles for quite some time. The Confucius Institute for Business London has been going since 2006-2007. And Charles and HSBC have been one of the founding fathers of the Institute. And not only has given support, has given enthusiasm, has given great ideas, and continues to do so. And we're very, very lucky that he's given time and energy to be here tonight, but to talk about a subject that I know is very, very close to his heart, not purely out of it's what I do and I work at a bank and banks are very important, but out of a really strong commitment to, I think, the way banks have to develop, can develop, and also the way the interaction between East and West is going to have to develop. And what I hear when Charles has spoken about this subject is not so much the facts, which are fascinating, not so much the ideas, which are absolutely crucial, but it's the passion and the enthusiasm and excitement I get when I hear somebody really at the top of his game, but also really interested in the potential of what he says and what he has to do. So that's what I'm in it for tonight, and I know that you're going to be really intrigued and I think deeply interested in what he has to say. For those of you who didn't look at his bio on the web or in some of the handouts, it makes great reading. We have everything for a spy novel, I think, actually, to be honest. We have the Foreign Office, a China specialist, Beijing 8286, 2000-2004. Postings in Canada, European security work, that sounds a bit interesting. In Vienna, well, you're too young in the audience for Vienna to be anything more than, I don't know, strudel, but for me, the Harry Lime and Third Man. London desk in Hong Kong, the Middle East, head of China section, deputy head of Far East Pacific Department. We've also got 1998-2000, seconded to a visa for the City UK, helping to restructure the organisation and develop a strategy for promoting UK financial services overseas through its embassies and high commissions. Returning to the embassy in Beijing as Director of Trade and Investment for China, absolutely crucial. Managing commercial offices in Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, Chongqing. Well, it goes on. And then 2008, the big year, HSBC, and 2011, the bank's financial sector policy unit, to respond to HSBC's external challenges and opportunities. And now we've got the big thing of also the responsibility for HSBC's China affairs. You're not going to get in one person somebody that has so much energy and experience. Very often, so I'd like to have a big round of applause, please, for Charles Haswell, who is a big student. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick. And after a start like that, I think I can only disappoint, so I'll do my best not to. And I'm very happy at the end of this to take questions, so I'm going to try and be a little bit provocative. There's some ideas in here which are new ideas. I'm very happy to discuss them, and we'll have time at the end for questions. The title of the talk is Global Financial Regulation Implications for China. Also, I'm going to touch on implications for the China-UK relationship, because I think there's an extent to which the UK in its history understands finance, and traditionally it's the US that has blown up the world. I'm going to stick quite closely to a text that I prepared because this is a rerun of a speech that I delivered at Tsinghua University in May of this year, I'll try not to make it too red, but it's good for reading it. But anyway, 10th of May this year, through the connection of the Confucius Institute for Business London, I had the great privilege to deliver a public lecture together with Andrew Shung of the Fund Global Institute at the Tsinghua School of Economics and Management in Beijing. This aroused some interest on the subject of macroeconomic cooperation between China and the UK, and I was delighted when the policy outcomes paper, which was issued on the 15th of October, after the recent economic and financial dialogue in Beijing between Chancellor George Osborne and Vice Premier Mark Cai, began with a commitment from both sides to, and I quote, strengthening their macroeconomic policy coordination. And I'm going to read a chunk of this because, and then forgive me again for reading, because I think it's important. So both sides pledged to enhance communication and dialogue in financial regulatory reform and promptly inform each other of the latest significant developments and policy measures adopted in domestic financial regulatory reform. The Bank of England will further share with the People's Bank of China new theories and experience in improving financial macro control and strengthening macroprudential policy frameworks. Both sides agreed to further improve and implement regulatory policy frameworks such as macroprudential management, the regulation of systemically important financial institutions, and resolution mechanisms through exchange of views and cooperation in the Financial Stability Board and other international standard-setting institutions. Both sides agreed to maintain a regular dialogue and cooperation over financial regulatory reforms. The Bank of England will continue to share with PBOC best practice advice on macroprudential policy implementation and microprudential supervision. That's a pretty big agenda, and I think it's terrific. But as far as I know, no other country has drawn up that kind of framework for cooperation with China other than the UK. It's much the kind of cooperation that I advocated in Beijing on the 10th of May, and I'm here today because the Confucius Institute for Business London has kindly arranged me to deliver a slightly updated, though very similar version of the lecture that I gave in Beijing. I began then with a little history, and I'm going to do the same again tonight. And one of the contributions that we can make at HSBC to the UK-China bilateral relationship is to provide dialogue and training at our headquarters in London for representatives from the Ministry of Finance, the People's Bank, SAFE, and the financial regulators. And earlier this year, we enjoyed the company of a small group from the Ministry of Finance, the People's Bank, and SAFE. And on their departure, they presented me with some very thoughtful gifts, including a coin commemorating the 30 years of the program of reform and opening, which started in China in 1978. That coin is precious to me because in its historical perspective, it broadly parallels my own association with China. As a foreigner, it has been an extraordinary privilege to have witnessed firsthand an economic and social transformation unprecedented in global history. What has happened in China in the past 30 years in terms of technological advancement, the improvement in the quality of life for so many people, and the widespread relief from poverty has no parallel in any nation at any point in the development of human civilization. But it does take me back, that 30 years, to my first encounters with China. I can remember visiting villages in Guangdong in the autumn of 1981, when Shenzhen was barely a gleam in the eye of the planners. Foreigners were still a novelty, and although people were shy to speak, when they did, often they were apologetic about the level of China's development at that time. And it made me wonder why this great nation, so ahead of so-called Western civilization for so long, had so fallen behind. And it took me some time to find out the answer to this question. I remember on one of my visits to Xi'an, China's ancient capital, being shown by a guide some of those famous pictures dating back to the Tang Dynasty. I'll start with my first slide here. This one, for example, portrays a marketplace in which it is possible to discern the faces of merchants from outside China. And the commentary from our tour guide was, come to Xi'an and see the China of the Tang Dynasty. This is a China that was open to the world and that traded with the world at a time when Chinese products penetrated to Europe and were highly prized. This is the normal China. But as she said, travel to Beijing and visit the palace built by the Ming, the dynasty that closed China, and you will understand what we lost. Now, I would describe this as slightly provocative marketing of her city by a locally loyal tourist guide, but she did have a point. At the height of the age of the Silk Road, China was linked through to Europe for the traffic of trade and ideas. At the Westin Hotel in Shanghai, some of you may have been there, in the Italian restaurant, there is an intriguing mural which depicts a line of noodles at the Great Wall, transforming across the geography of the world by the time it reaches Venice into spaghetti. Some of you may have seen this, and if you go to Shanghai, I recommend it. I call it the noodle spaghetti line. And as the 15th century wore on, it became broken. It was the Hongxi Emperor, Zhu Gaoshi, who, when he came to the imperial throne in 1424, cancelled the maritime expeditions of Admiral Zheng He, burned the fleet, and abolished some forms of frontier trade. Over the subsequent centuries, China turned in on herself and lost the momentum which had generated such cultural depth and so much innovation. This was a tragedy not just for China, but for the world. Imagine, for example, a China of the 19th century in which Chinese inventors and entrepreneurs had access to finance to develop their ideas. And imagine the shape of the world today if that had been the case. But finance is not the starting point. The human practice of lending and borrowing is very ancient. Borrowing facilitates an economic activity that was impossible without the borrowed resource. In ancient Mesopotamia, farmers would borrow seed corn to sow their fields. They recorded their obligation to pay back the lender and stipulated the amount, the place, and the time. This could be denominated, for example, in bags of corn, the fruit of their own labor in the fields. And sometimes such an obligation would be collateralized, for example, through a commitment by one farmer to send his son to work in the fields of the lender until the debt obligation had been met. The records were made by pressing sticks into the wet clay of tablets, creating wedge shapes that we know today as cuneiform. We know that some of these tablets were traded, they became a medium of exchange. In Western civilization, these are the earliest forms of human writing. And it is interesting that they were CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, and that they were created before religious writing or poetry. And of course, CDOs were the instruments that had almost bent down the financial system in 2008. Only much later does money become the borrowed resource, the object of lending and borrowing. Ultimately, it was money that drove the extraordinary economic development of recent centuries. Historically, the European economy is pretty much flatlined for hundreds of years. Change came at the end of the 15th century, just as China was closing to the world. A crucial development was the Spanish conquering of much of Latin America and the return of their ships to Europe, laden with silver. This increase in Europe's money supply helped to finance the Renaissance and demonstrated the simple economic truth that for there to be an expansion of output, there must be an expansion of money. Reginald McKenna, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer and then Chairman of the Midland Bank, which some of you know was acquired by HSBC, at the time when it was the largest bank in the world, this was from 1918 until his death in 1943, he was chairman for that period, he said in 1927, as population increases, as we hope to raise the standards of living right through the nation, it must follow that the production of goods and services must increase, and if they are to increase in their amount, it will equally follow that money must increase in amount. You cannot have a larger volume of trade which alone will provide for a higher standard of living in the country unless you have more money. Sounds very simplistic by today's standards. Now, as important of the increase in money supply. In 1494, just 70 years after the Hongxi Emperor came to the throne, Franciscan friar Luca Pacioli published the first book on double-entry bookkeeping, and that enabled a record of debits and credits to be kept by entering a single transaction as both, one each side of a balance sheet. If netting all debts and credits off at the end of the day did not return you to your original sum of equity, you knew there had to be an error. It was a simple checking mechanism. That was one crucial development. The other came through the role of goldsmiths in society. And carrying gold around, since that was people's personal wealth, was quite hazardous. And so the goldsmiths offered a safe place where gold could be deposited in return for a note which guaranteed title to the quantity of gold stored. Owners of the gold soon realised that they did not need to return to the goldsmiths to recover some of the gold every time they wanted to make a payment. They could simply trade the notes. And as this practice extended, the goldsmiths soon realised that the owners of the gold very rarely returned for it. So they began to put the gold in their vaults to work by lending it out at interest. And then the final stage came when goldsmiths realised that they could issue notes which their customers would regard as tradable, even if there were more notes than the real quantity of gold, the real quantity of gold in the vault could support. And in this way, the goldsmiths were able to develop the process of credit creation on the back of their role as deposit takers. Now, the first bank, Monte dei Piaschi di Siena, was founded in Italy in 1472 at the western end of the Silk Road, and only a few decades after the Noodle Spaghetti Line had ceased to operate as a carrier of trade and ideas. Banks were able to take advantage of the invention of double-entry bookkeeping. A loan to a customer could be recorded as a debit, and his deposit created by that loan recorded as a credit. The two would net off, leaving no hole in the bank's equity. The balance sheet would have got bigger, but the amount by which it had expanded would not have come from anywhere, any more than the notes issued by the goldsmiths, which had nothing real to back them. The trick was that because the goldsmiths did have some real deposits in their vaults, people believed in their notes. Banks, provided they had some real customer deposits, were able to pull off the same trick. As you probably know, the word credit stems from the Latin verb credo, credit, he believes. It is about belief, it's not about much else. Now, if all this sounds fanciful, let me quote the words of one of the former deputy governors of the Bank of England, Paul Tucker. This was at a speech he gave in Brussels last year, when he was talking about shadow banking. And he said, anyone running a maturity mismatch is exposed to liquidity risk, liabilities being called before assets fall due or before they can be sold in an orderly way. Banks can provide insurance against such liquidity risk because their deposit liabilities are money. They can lend simply by expanding the two sides of their balance sheet simultaneously, creating broad money. Now, while this explanation of the role of banks might be surprising to some, an additional surprise might be to learn the extent of the proportion of broad money in a modern economy that arises from this source. In the UK, it is 97%. Central bank notes, coins and deposits, what we call base money, make up only about 3%. So the role of the banks in supplying adequate money to ensure that output can expand is really very significant. But as Reginald McKenna told his shareholders in 1924, I'm afraid the ordinary citizen will not much like to be told that the banks can and do create and destroy money. The amount of finance in existence varies only with the action of the banks in increasing or decreasing deposits and bank purchases. We know how this is affected. Every loan, overdraft, or bank purchase creates a deposit, and every repayment of a loan, overdraft, or bank sale destroys a deposit. And this might sound to any of you who study banking as completely back to front, because certainly when I joined HSBC, I was told we're a very traditional institution. We take deposits and we lend money. Only later did I realise that that's actually back to front. I mentioned that bank-created money in the UK was about 97% of broad money. Globally, the figures are significant too. In 1990, the global economy was around $22 trillion, depending on how you measure it. By 2010, it was around $75 trillion. That's a difference of $53 trillion over 20 years. And understanding the process of credit creation helps us to understand where much of that $53 trillion came from. But perhaps more important than the sheer numbers has been the social impact. Before the advent of banks, wealth was the preserve of the privileged and possibly violent few. Violence secured wealth, and violence protected it. Individual citizens with a skill or an idea or simply their labour would often have to secure support from the wealthy to monetize what they had to offer. So the chances are that their skill or idea or labour would simply help sustain the wealth of those already wealthy. Now, once loans were available from banks on fair terms, individuals could borrow to monetize their skills or ideas or labour for their own benefit, to set up and grow their own companies, or to leverage equity raised from investors. I call this the democratization of prosperity, and it could imply that the most deeply and successfully socialist institutions that mankind has ever devised are banks. Now, the problem with bank credit, to quote a UK committee report in 1931, is that it is essentially unstable. The history of finance is a history of volatility, of booms and busts. Booms and busts have direct social consequences. In Europe, it was the effect on Germany's economy and society of punitive demands for war reparations to pay for the damage of the First World War, which provided fertile ground for the growth of national socialism and the rise of Nazism. The financial collapses of the late 1920s created the depression and the social dislocation of the 1930s. Out of that decade came the horrors of the Second World War. It was a decade of events that we must be careful not to repeat. Yet if you look at the West's response to the financial crisis of 2007 and 8, and the state of our economies since, we have seen signs of social dislocation which are unnerving. Europe's nascent recovery remains fragile, and an unstable Europe would be as damaging to the global economy as an unstable China. Now, I mentioned a UK committee report of 1931. In 1929, the British government decided that it did not sufficiently understand the linkages between the financial system and the economy. It established a committee on finance and industry, and the mandate of that committee was to inquire into banking, finance and credit, paying regard to the factors both internal and international which govern their operation, and to make recommendations calculated to enable these agencies to promote the development of trade and commerce and the employment of labour. I rather wish the British government had done the same thing in 2008. The chairman of this committee was a Scottish lawyer called Hugh Macmillan, and by his name the committee is more widely known. The members of the committee included one John Maynard Keynes, and of course our friend Reginald McKenna. A key recommendation of the Macmillan committee was that the function of a central bank should be to regulate the volume and price of bank credit. Now, I'm going to argue that this recommendation holds as good today as it did in 1931. The problem then was that the volume of bank credit was catalogued in handwritten ledgers. There was no way of assimilating or aggregating the data, and without data it was very hard for central banks to know when or how to act. After the Nixon shock of 1971, when the US president detached the US dollar from its gold base, unnerved the oil producers who were paid in dollars, and engendered a period of high financial volatility and rampant inflation, some central banks did experiment with quantitative controls. In the UK, direct restrictions on consumer credit and bank lending gave way to something called the Supplementary Special Deposit Scheme, also known as the Corset. And this sought to limit credit expansion by imposing penalties on banks whose interest-bearing deposits grew faster than a preset limit. That idea, the corset idea, was abandoned in 1980. Attempts at quantitative controls were replaced by a new theology developed by the Chicago School of Economists. This focused on inflation targeting and the use of a single policy instrument, the short-term interest rate, to keep prices stable. Simplicity, transparency, and predictability of the mechanism was intended to make monetary policy almost self-fulfilling, both in terms of the response of markets and the choices made by businesses and households. For a truly excellent exploration of the development of monetary policy, I would commend a speech delivered in Edmonton on the 1st of May by Mark Carney, while he was still the central bank governor in Canada. The problem with monetary policy was that it looked as if it worked. During the period we now know as the Great Moderation, overall inflation stayed close to targets and prices were remarkably stable. It really appeared as if the volatility inherent in the financial system had been tamed, despite the growth of considerable economic imbalances and the emergence of asset price inflation that looked suspiciously like bubbles. But the theology taught that underlying the financial system was an essential equilibrium, which meant that if a bubble burst, the central bank would clean up and equilibrium would be restored. It was not thought that preemptive action was needed. Low inflation, stable prices, and low returns drove a search for yield. The complacency engendered by apparent stability fostered higher risk-taking. What in fact was happening was that with little regulation, the whole financial system was being leveraged up and credit volumes were expanding without restraint. This was permitted for a simple and, with hindsight, misguided reason. The models used by economists and central banks generally did not include the financial system, banks, and bank credit. I find that astonishing. And this, in turn, was for another very simple reason. The notion of money that had crept into the minds of economists was not rooted in that idea of a borrowed resource that I mentioned earlier in this lecture. A borrowed resource facilitates new economic activity. Combined with human input, it creates new value within the economy. And where the borrowed resource is an addition to the money supply, created in the form of a new bank loan, the output derived from it is an expansion above the steady state of economic activity. That's what we call economic growth. Since the source of credit creation is the banking system, it follows that the connection between the banking system and the economy is pretty direct. But the notion of money on which economists and central bankers built their models was derived from a different concept. The French economist Valras had suggested that money was simply a facilitator of barter, a neutral factor in the economy. It helped things to move around, but had nothing to do with making new things. In an NBE working paper, NBER working paper of 2009, two professors, Alan Taylor, University of California, and Moritz Schalarik of the Free University of Berlin, documented the history of attitudes to bank credit by academics. They characterized this in three phases. The money view, associated with Friedman and Schwartz, in which the actual functions of banks and their role in credit creation via bank loans are of no great importance. The irrelevance view, associated with Modigliani and Miller, where finance was a so-called veil. Money, models with money were rare, and models with any sort of financial structure almost non-existent. And the credit view, associated with Mishkin, Bernanke, and Gertler, where credit can have an accelerator effect on monetary policy, but remains by and large passive as a propagator of shocks, but not an independent source of shocks. As late as 1995, Bernanke and Gertler stated that the credit channel is an enhancement mechanism, not a truly independent or parallel channel. Now, it'll be apparent from what I've said that in the real world, leaving bank credit creation out of the equations was a serious miscalculation. It allowed central banks to take their eye off the massive credit expansion that was happening during what we call the Great Moderation. And as confirmation, Mark Carney said in his speech on the 1st of May, it's safe to say that most policymakers didn't see the crisis coming. In part, this was because central banks underappreciated the scale of endogenous liquidity creation in the system, i.e. the independent endogenous creation of credit by the banks. The somewhat contorted language is how central bankers do tend to mask that activity of banks that, as Reginald McKenna said, the ordinary citizen will not like to be told about. But if this is what banks do, and the impact of it has been demonstrated by the crisis, it follows that the very idea of equilibrium must be a fiction. Banks are able to upset any notional equilibrium at any time simply by adding money to the system, albeit within the constraints of their risk appetite, that's the likelihood of being paid back, and the ratio of lending to capital required by regulators. That has serious implications for the way in which economic theory has been developed in Western academic institutions over the past half century, and for the policy frameworks for finance ministries and central banks that have grown out of that theory. Perhaps not surprisingly, the Basel Committee working paper last year, number 20, commented, "It is now obvious that economic models and analysis must account for the state of the financial system when forecasting the evolution of the macro economy." One might say, duh. Moreover, the crisis has shown that linear approximations based on data from normal economic times fail in periods of financial sector stress. Such issues highlight the need to improve our understanding of the role of the financial sector in the monetary transmission channel. But Nate, the financial sector is still characterized as a factor in the monetary transmission channel. Even this language doesn't recognize the independent, endogenous nature of the role of banks. And Mark Carney argued we should not go back to the drawing board and start again, and that there is much that can be done to refine monetary policy so that it can deliver what the theory predicts, including by extending the operation of monetary policy in the time dimension. And we subsequently seen him carry this through in the Bank of England's policy of forward guidance. But in his Edmonton speech, he went on to say, "The financial crisis has given renewed importance to earlier research aimed at including in policy models the interactions between financial market imperfections and the real economy. To reflect fully financial market dynamics, the deceptive simplicity and elements of elegance of complete markets operating in linear, rational expectations environments must give way to the chaotic reality of heterogeneous beliefs, risk-taking behavior, feedback effects from excess leverage, endogenous uncertainty, and a non-trivial role for financial intermediaries." That is hard enough to pronounce, let alone do, but progress is being made and eventual payoff will be large. And many central banks are now attempting to build models of the economy which include the financial system. Across Europe, something called the Macroprudential Research Network, which is known as MARS for short, under the direction of the European Central Bank, has scores of extremely clever academics working on different aspects of this problem. Of independent academics, I know of only one, Steve Keen, in Australia, who has made real progress on new models. And Steve, some of you may have been in his lecture, I think, last year, when he came and did a Radio 4 money programme from the old theatre here. It's very difficult work. The beautiful, elegant simplicity of a single policy target, a single policy instrument, and a single objective looks under threat. Mark Carney delivered a forceful defence for its survival in his Edmonton speech, and he's right. But I'll come back to why I'd advocate a slightly different approach beyond that point. Before doing so, I want to touch on the regulatory response to the crisis, something that in my function in HSBC I live every day. In the quotation above, Mark Carney made a reference to some of the ideas that governed attitudes before the crisis, ideas about equilibrium, about perfect information, about markets that clear. Like the views of money dating back to Barras, that it is a neutral, frictionless facilitator, these belong in the realm of pure theory and have been found to have little grounding in the gritty reality of a human economy. The equivalent in the realm of bank regulation today is a set of ideas about bank capital, which arrive at the conclusion that banks can hold very high levels of capital and remain an attractive proposition to investors, and can still continue to generate credit. At root, these ideas rest on a simple proposition that more capital makes banks safer, and that as they then become a lower risk investment, investors will be willing to accept a lower return from them. And this proposition fails on a number of counts, not least that the drop in riskiness does not track the drop in return. Investors do not worry about how much money they might lose if a bank fails. They do worry about the likelihood that it will fail. Much beyond a capital ratio of about 10%, the likelihood of failure, something we used to articulate as the confidence interval, does not shrink very much for each additional 1% of capital, and the shrinkage gets smaller with each added percent. By contrast, the return continues to drop in proportion to the addition of capital. So rational investors simply back off, and high capital ratio requirements become an absolute constraint on the capacity of banks to create credit. It has to be remembered in this context that retained earnings, which can be used to build up capital, don't belong to the business. They belong to the owner of the business, the shareholders, who have a right to determine how their earnings might be spent. Now, the progenitors of these ideas have confused probability of default, which stops changing very much as capital levels rise beyond a certain point, with loss given default and related loss absorbency. The argument is driven by loss absorbency because of the perception that taxpayers have bailed out the Western banks that came near to failure, and that this must never happen again. So banks should have enough loss absorbency in their liability structure to absorb all potential losses in a crisis, absorbing taxpayers of any impact. And never mind that as pensioners, many of the very same taxpayers will be expected to take the impact through such instruments as bail-in debt, which will have come from their pension contributions. And never mind that in a crisis, the value of assets can drop to nothing if there is no market for them, despite the fact that as assets held to maturity, most, if not all, their value will be preserved. I'll return to this point. I mention all this only because the debate about high capital has superseded, to a large extent, the consensus which achieved the prescriptions of the Basel III regime for capital, liquidity and leverage. In a paper from the Policy Exchange, a conservative think tank, James Barty argued earlier this year that the accumulation of Basel III measures, together with additional policies pursued in the UK through the UK's new regulatory architecture, are starving the UK economy of credit and hindering economic recovery. But drawing on the work of Friedman and Krauss in their book Engineering the Financial Crisis, he also conducts an examination of the Basel regime, which is being implemented in the run-up to the crisis, and concludes that Basel II, because the ratings issued by agencies reflected theoretical risk instead of real ones, was a formula for the accumulation of fissile material in the banking system. And to this mix, that's a monetary framework with money missing, a capital regime with important flaws, we must add the influence of government policy. From President Bush Sr. through the Clinton years to Bush Jr., there was a preoccupation with home ownership. Home ownership became almost the expression of what it meant to be American. A fact perhaps illustrated by the name of George W. Bush's last legislation on the subject. It was called the American Dream Down Payment Act of 2003. Passed unanimously by Congress, it's now ironic to think that it carried the support of Senator Dodd and Congressman Frank. But the law was predicated on the conviction that the miracles of modern finance in an age of financial stability achieved through price stability could take people out of trailer parks and into homes they couldn't afford. And to this volatile mix of this policy background, all that was needed were the animal spirits of greedy and irresponsible bankers to ignite chaos. Monetary policy fails to accommodate the importance of credit creation and needs a redesign. We have a new regulatory regime which might make banks safer, but which can hinder their interaction with the economy, not least because sometime after the design of the new regime, its architects, that's the Basel Committee, found themselves back at the very question that was asked of the Millen Committee in 1929. And of course, in the UK, our new housing policy is beginning to look a little like the US model again. In short, we haven't got very far in designing a new financial system fit to meet the aspirations of our respective populations in the 21st century. My reason for travelling to Tsinghua in May was to argue that my audience there, the rising generation of Chinese economists, should not allow themselves to be left out of the process of designing a financial system that is fit for purpose. I told them that their Western counterparts, both in the fields of policy and regulation, have brought the evolution of the financial system over the past 500 years to where it is now, and that Basel III had created a breathing space, but one in which banks in developed economies would deleverage, output would slow, and unemployment would continue to rise. I said that the need to move on was urgent, taking into account some of the basic principles that govern finance and the economy. In China, for example, there is an appreciation of the need to regulate the volume of credit, as well as the price through monetary policy. Official administrative action, which include adjustment to reserve requirements and restrictions on mortgage loan-to-value ratios, have been partially effective. In Hong Kong, which has no monetary policy tools, because its currency is pegged to the dollar, so the tools are in Washington, the authorities have also made use of administrative tools. This experience needs to be brought to the global discussion. But at the same time, administrative actions can be unpredictable and can push financial activity into the unofficial sector, the shadow sector. So we need the simplicity, transparency, and predictability which Mark Carney champions. So the creation of a new financial system should be a shared endeavour, not one in which China should be dictated to by the very schools of thought and organisations that have got it wrong before. The importance of that shared endeavour has now been recognised through the economic and financial dialogue. Mark Carney concluded his Edmonton speech with a confession that he had left more questions than answers. His prescription that we should persist with monetary policy until it comes good could prove risky and could be questioned in the light of a paper written last year by his fellow countryman, William White, which was called Ultra-Easy Monetary Policy and the Law of Unintended Consequences. The markets were not convinced when Governor Carney put his theory into practice through forward guidance earlier this year, and the certainty that he tried to bring to the level of interest rates is already being undermined. The truth is that, as was the case in the 1930s, increasing social dislocation in some developed economies means we might not have the luxury of time. So I want to offer some answers to leave you this evening with something to think about in the form of one quite simple idea. In a speech last year at Jackson Hole entitled The Dog and the Frisbee, Andrew Haldane from the Bank of England made a plea for simplicity, suggesting that continuous accretion of rulemaking was creating a regulatory framework too complicated and too easy to arbitrage. He argued for a simple leverage ratio to govern the financial system, a theme on which Thomas Honig of the FDIC subsequently expanded, and a theme that had since gathered considerable momentum. The beauty of a leverage ratio is that it is a simple, blunt measure. It's not risk sensitive, and it's not hostage to dodgy risk modelling. The danger of a leverage ratio is that it is a simple, blunt measure, is not risk sensitive, and therefore cannot identify where the stresses might be in the system. It is just an average. If Bill Gates came and joined us in here, on average, we all become multi-billionaires. Average does not identify who could buy us drinks all night. No crops failed in an average year. No one died on an average plane journey. A leverage ratio at a bank of 6% doesn't tell you if it has a well-balanced portfolio of assets or a clutch of assets at the margin, which, as risk levels change, which they do, can wipe out all the bank's capital. And we know that setting a leverage ratio as a limit can create perverse outcomes. A building society like Nationwide, or a very conservative bank, say one that takes deposits and buys only sovereign debt, will quickly hit the leverage ratio limit and be incentivized to take on a proportion of higher risk assets if it wants to expand its business. The leverage ratio becomes the binding constraint, and yet it doesn't contain enough information for such an important role. We think there is a different way to look at leverage, which could take account and take advantage of the positive qualities of a leverage ratio. It appears a small change, but it is a fundamental shift. I talked earlier of the problem that during the Great Moderation, the entire financial system was being leveraged up. This included leverage generated by the shadow system through securitization, and also the personal leverage of many of us ordinary citizens. So to respond to this systemic shift, here's the proposal. A leverage ratio for the whole financial system, not for individual banks, but for the whole system, should be set as a target by government. It would be the expression of a government's risk appetite for the economy, and the central bank or other macroprudential authority would be required to keep leverage to the set target. Nobody else has floated this idea that leverage should be a target. It's always been proposed as a limit. It's a subtle, but it's a fundamental change. And the reason for this is that leverage should not be allowed to run too high, but equally, it should not be allowed to drop too low. If there is a lack of leverage in the conventional banking system, the pull of economic demand, when it is there, will arouse credit creation and credit intermediation in unconventional ways. As a symmetrical target, the leverage ratio would be similar to the inflation target for monetary policy. There would also be a single policy instrument, the parallel to the short-term interest rate for monetary policy. And that adjustment would be to capital requirements for the banks. As the leverage ratio rises above target, the central bank or the macroprudential authority would have to identify asset classes displaying increased risk, for example, a higher proportion of high loan-to-value mortgages at higher multiples of salary. It would then require more capital against those asset classes. But equally, if leverage is sinking too low, leading to a shortage of credit and economic underperformance, the central bank or macroprudential authority would need to bring overall capital ratio requirements down. And this would be safe to do because the mechanism would exist to raise ratios again when needed. As in the case of monetary policy, where the debate over how to calibrate inflation continues, so I expect the debate about how to calibrate leverage would be ongoing. That debate would not stop us putting in place serviceable mechanisms which, although probably over-conservative at first, would get better over time. To my mind, we have a choice. Either we spend years trying to build economic models which incorporate the banks, like the Mars Network, or we stand back and ask ourselves what a macroeconomic policy framework might look like were we now to take account of the financial system, banks, and credit. This is what we've done, and this is the idea that we've come up with. And I have a set of slides which I'll run through quite quickly, setting out the detail. And I think the slides are available for anybody who wants to study these are slightly longer than. On this slide here, no one see that. Difficult there. Essentially, you've got two factors here that are very familiar. You've got monetary policy on the left-hand side here, and you've got fiscal policy. And what monetary policy is to enable you to keep prices stable, it's about an inflation target, which is your benchmark, and you then adjust interest rates in order to keep prices stable. What it doesn't do is affect the volume of money in the system. And then over on the far side, you've got fiscal policy, again, very familiar. What's been missing since the creation of monetary policy has been the bit in the middle, which is the management of the volume of money. And essentially, that's what I've just talked you through here, that you have a leverage target set by a government, you then have a requirement for the central bank or the macroprudential authority to keep leverage to target by adjusting capital ratios. When you look at it in that sense, you honestly wonder how on earth we thought we could run a financial system with monetary discipline, a bit of fiscal discipline, but not enough, but no credit discipline. I'm not going to dwell on this. This is the first question anybody asks when I put these ideas out is to say what happens across borders, because you have one regulator which will tighten the capital requirements for its banks. What happens about cross-border banks? This is just a picture of how you can use the existing financial structures, the the European Systemic Risk Board and the Financial Stability Board to ensure that you don't get that kind of leakage across borders. Again, I won't dwell on this, but this is the kind of flowchart of how this works. There's a whole lot of data that you need to look at within the economy to see how risk is evolving in different asset classes. That feeds through to your financial policy authority. In the case of the UK, that's the new Financial Policy Committee, produces a financial stability report, which has specific recommendations about levels of capital in the system, and that then flows through to the banks. And here's a chart which really shows you how monetary policy and what I would like to call financial policy, I don't like the word macroprudential, it's a very ugly word, actually perfectly fit. These two things should be running parallel, and we should have done. You've got an economic issue, the price of finance and the supply of the volume of finance. The determinant for your price of finance is inflation. The determinant for your volume of finance is the amount of leverage in the system. The principal tool you've got for monetary policy is short-term interest rates adjusted by the central bank. And the principal tool that you have for financial policy is adjustment to your capital ratios. You've got an implementation channel. Those who are familiar with monetary policy will know that the adjustments are made through the open markets operations of central banks. But you can use Basel Pillar 2, which is part of the microprudential regulatory system for banks for the adjustment of capital. What's the objective? Stable price of finance. We know about that, people are familiar with that. But a stable and sustainable supply and volume of finance is the piece that's been missing. In terms of the government, what's its determinant? In the case of monetary policy, it's its tolerance of inflation. I can remember when there was a period when economists thought that zero inflation was the goal. They didn't try and move towards zero inflation. An experiment over time has made everybody settle at around 2% as the optimum. And in a lot of countries, that has now become a symmetrical target. You don't want to go too much above it, but you don't want to go too below it, too far below it. And then in terms of financial policy, what's the determinant? The government's risk appetite. All businesses, HSBC, has to determine its appetite for risk. It's a decision that goes right up, is approved by our board, and then filters down and determines all our financial decisions. A government should have to articulate its risk appetite, and this would be the way to do it. And then if you look at the target, as I say, we've settled on 2% for inflation. My sort of guess for optimal leverage in the system is 4%. That's 25 times. That sounds quite high. But it means that once you get up to about 30 times, you need to bring it back down again, but also if leverage drops below about 20 times, you probably need to move it back up again. So essentially, and then there's implications for the euro and the stability of the euro, which I won't dwell on here. Just very quickly, the Bank of England has actually done a lot of work on this. The question is, what's the kind of data you look at? This is from a paper that they produced in January of this year, which lists the heading of data. So a lot of the groundwork in terms of, okay, well, how would this work in practice? A lot of that work has already been done. And you end up with a three-legged stool of financial stability. Essentially, we've tried to balance financial stability on fiscal discipline, on monetary discipline. Two-legged stools tend not to be very stable, and in 2007-2008, we discovered that. And then just on the question of why leverage. These are government figures for leverage of the UK banks, and there's a pretty strong correlation between the amount of leverage in the system and the crisis that happened. So what you see is a period of hugely increased leverage from sort of 2003-2004 onwards. And if you think about it, my target, I'm saying, is 4%, it's about here, 25 times. So if you imagine that we'd had a system like this in place, in about 2003, the central bank would have had to say, there's too much leverage in the financial system, we need to get it down, we need more capital in the financial system. And through this mechanism, they'd have known where to put it. And the final slide I've got is just, it's very interesting that we talk about the extent of losses being created by the financial crisis. And very often what these calculations have done is to take that period of excessive leverage and extrapolate that forward as if that was a sustainable period of growth. So again, these are government figures. That's the period, the same period that I've shaded in the previous graph. And as you can see, they've taken the angle of that graph and extrapolated it forward. Well, this level of leverage was never sustained, so we were never heading towards this kind of level of growth. Just go back to the start. What this framework does is to regulate the volume of bank credit in the economy against risk. It complements monetary policy, which regulates an important component of the price of bank credit, which is the short-term interest rate, against an inflation target in order to keep prices stable. So when I said that Mark Carney was right to defend the survival of monetary policy, it's because I believe that we should keep it as it is, without attempting to tinker with it in the time dimension, for the reasons set out by Bill White in his paper. What we need, however, is a parallel mechanism to do what monetary policy cannot do, which is regulate the volume of credit. It failed to do that in the Great Moderation, when credit expansion got out of hand, and it is failing now because even long-term, low interest rates cannot restore volume if the banks do not have the capacity to create credit. And using the simple mechanism of leverage target, with adjustments to capital determined by levels of risk, avoids the danger that this is some form of old-fashioned credit control or manifestation of industrial policy. Like monetary policy, this is a simple, predictable, and perhaps even ultimately self-fulfilling framework. As you'll see, there's nothing new in what I'm suggesting, which was recommended by the McMillan Committee 82 years ago. What is new is the idea that a simple, transparent, and predictable mechanism to regulate credit volume could be based on something as straightforward as a leverage target. Judging the leverage of the financial system, let's say assets over capital, should not be beyond the capabilities of a modern central bank and would have the advantage that it would capture the so-called shadow or unofficial sector. I've left one final strand to tie up at the end of my speech, and that relates to the issue of bailout and the impact on taxpayers. It is a popular belief in the UK that the banks that nearly failed were rescued by the taxpayer. It is true that the use by the government of its balance sheet exposed the taxpayer to contingent risk. That should not happen. But what is not true is that money provided direct by the taxpayer was on the other side of the transactions under which the British government acquired shares in the failing banks. Indeed, money taken from taxpayers in 2008-2009, which is the year of the bailouts, was less than in the previous year. The money for those transactions was supplied by the National Loans Fund, which is the fund into which the government's Debt Management Office pays the proceeds of its sales of gilts, British government bonds. Following the failure of Lehman's, the Treasury asked the Debt Management Office to raise additional cash to top up the National Loans Fund in anticipation of trouble. The DMO issued quantities of short-term, that's 14 to 30-day debt, which it was able to do cheaply at a time when banks were not lending to each other. And the banks which had become safe havens, like HSBC, were looking for somewhere to put their inflow of new deposits. From January of 2009, that 14 to 30-day debt was rolled over into longer-term gilts. So the money used to buy shares in Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds was raised from the markets and therefore supplied by banks and private sector institutional investors. In terms of actual money, on the day, the financial system was bailed out by the financial system. It is the politics behind this that has created the vision of actual money being stripped from taxpayers. Civil servants have to face politicians with a decision to expose taxpayers to privately generated risks. That is not a comfortable thing to do. And the other critical point is that such decisions can only be carried through if the government's own fiscal policies are credible to the markets, who would otherwise not be willing to lend to it. But of course, at the time these transactions took place, the convention was that government borrowing was risk-free, and for governments free to print their own money, that is true in a nominal, if not actual, value sense. If the government were to sell back its shares in the banks at a loss, then repayment of the balance of the debt raised would have to come from the taxpayer or another source of government revenue. But until that loss materialises, only the cost of servicing the debt would notionally fall to the taxpayer. And even this could be balanced by sale of the government shares in the banks at a profit, as the US government had achieved. Just one other point before I finish this digression. Provision of liquidity by a central bank or government to fund a bank's assets at a time when market sources of funding have seized up prevents a bank taking mark-to-market losses in its portfolio. It is those mark-to-market losses that require bailing at a time that banks appear insolvent. Another truth, which the ordinary citizen would not like to be told, is that at any point in time, a bank is, by its very nature, insolvent. It cannot meet its liabilities because they are deployed to fund assets that it cannot immediately cash. But if it does not need to cash those assets because their funding is supported temporarily by central bank or government liquidity, it does not have to realise losses and therefore does not need additional capital or debt to absorb those losses. That could be helpful in a world in which the encumbrance of an increasing proportion of debt through the requirement of collateral could make real bail-in debt prohibitively expensive. That is the significance of Mark Carney's most recent speech on the 24th of October on the provision of Bank of England liquidity, and should be borne in mind as we devise new structures for loss absorbency. Governor Carney was simply mirroring across the Atlantic the provisions for liquidity that already exist under Title II of Dodd-Frank. He was also following the guidance of Walter Bagehot, who set out his prescription for liquidity in the 19th century, except in one crucial aspect. Bagehot said that central banks should lend at penal rates because the penal rates incentivise banks to run off their non-performing assets as quickly as they can, and the temporary liquidity allows them the time to deploy their capital to meet actual losses in the portfolio, as Paul Tucker would say, in an orderly way, rather than be destroyed by notional losses dictated by a broken market. Governor Carney is offering rather greater leniency. I made the point earlier that taxpayers should not be exposed to contingent risk. Confirmation that liquidity will be available reduces the chances that those risks will be realised in a crisis. But until governments bring in some form of regulation of credit volume, perhaps on the lines that I have suggested, taxpayers, the citizens of our countries, are likely to continue to be exposed to contingent risks. This might not be the risk of paying for failure, but it could be the risk of the consequences of credit starvation, which, as we can see, are far more serious. Earlier in this lecture, I said that the world had been impoverished by China's isolation. Ironically, the nimble spaghetti line went down just as the key innovations that helped fund modern banking were about to be explored at the spaghetti end of the line. Yet China helped to stabilise the global economy after a perfect financial storm for which Western monetary policy, regulatory policy, social policy, and the behaviour of Western bankers provided the ingredients. Sometimes history gives us a second chance. Now is one of those times when we must take it. The world can only be enriched if China, and specifically China's rising generation of economists, can be part of designing a financial system fit for our people's aspirations in the 21st century. The government's economic and financial dialogue with China provides the vehicle for exactly this, and perhaps with it the opportunity to avoid an end to the decade following the financial crisis of 2007 or 2008, a bit like the decade that followed 1929. Thank you very much.
Take a seat and a break. I'd really like to thank you again. We are short for time, so I'm not going to attempt at any summary. I'm just going to give a little bit of time for some water to be taken. I've got one of the roaming mics. I think I've got the only roaming mic. Can I pass that to one of the team? And I think we're all mic'd up here. We'll see how the questions are going to go. If they're quite complicated, we'll do it one by one. If there seem to be some short, sharp ones, we'll take them in groups. So I've got a question from at the back. You can get the microphone over. And really clear, if you could actually state who you are, what you do, it'd actually be a little favour as well. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Michael Farage, I'm an investment strategist. Thank you very much for a fascinating talk. Just on the monetary discipline, credit discipline, and fiscal discipline, On the monetary business, I'd love to get your thoughts on the fact that monetary policy in the Western world, in both the US and Europe, are very much preemptive, kind of asymmetric, in the sense that they tackle credit contraction as opposed to credit expansion. And the second aspect, in terms of the credit element, you talked about leverage. What normally happens with leverage during a leverage period is that asset prices tend to go up, and it tends to be justified by the fact that asset prices have gone up. Would, you know, it'd be great to get your thoughts on that as well.
Well, all those things are right. and one of the things that I mentioned was that when you talk about leverage and you say, when you set a leverage target, the first question that I always get is, okay, that's fine, but how do you calibrate leverage? And what happens when actually the process of leverage is increasing asset value, so it looks like the leverage figure isn't changing. If you go back to that slide that I briefly showed you of the Bank of England data, the two columns of data, actually, if you go back and you look through the categories of data in terms of looking past slices of the economy, mortgage lending, all the rest of it, it is possible with that data now to identify where the leverage is being manifested within the system and to be selective about asset classes. And I think one of the key things here is that since the crisis, we've tended to focus on institutions, too big to fail, banks and so on. Actually, what causes the financial system to blow up is not individual banks or bank structures or business models of banks, it's asset classes. And usually it's a familiar asset classes, it's property. So I think part of this is getting away from banks and leverage in individual institutions and looking much further into the economy and at asset classes within the economy and arriving over a period of time at a calibration of leverage which makes sense within this context. So, but you heard all this here first. I genuinely believe in 20 years' time that the idea of a leverage target and an inflation target will be commonplace. But we are still arguing about how to calibrate inflation, RPI, CPI, and so on. 20 years' time, I think we'll still be arguing about how to calibrate leverage. That shouldn't stop us putting a system in place.
Great question, Stoffel. Second question here, please. Sorry, you're going to be working hard with that mic.
Regulation and the globalization of capital flows. You know, the globalization of trade really brought great prosperity for the whole world, and China is the biggest beneficiary, arguably. Then, I guess, going hand in hand would be the globalization of capital flows. So, capital goes to wherever the product busy world is the biggest. So my question for you is that what do you think the kind of global infrastructure of regulations which tend to be set by individual countries can accommodate this capital globalization? Do you think we have done good enough or there is quite a big issue to be tackled? And what's the implication, you think, for big international financial institutions? Usually this is one thing. And I guess when China becomes even more open in capital and become a capital exporter, then big Chinese banks would come to international level. So, yeah, what's your thinking?
Thank you. I think that's a really good question. And I mean, I'm from that boomer generation. We've grown up in a world with a level of good fortune that I can't imagine any previous generation has ever enjoyed. And we've been fantastically lucky. And part of what I think is really important is that the planet we hand on to the next generation has the same kind of opportunities. You're exactly right. Globalization has been a really important factor in all of that. And I share what's coming across as your fear. A lot of what's happening in regulation will actually restrict globalization. You'll get the balkanization of finance, you'll get the foreign banking organization laws in the US, you'll get retaliation in Europe, you'll have the compartmentalization of finance, and that inability to finance trade, to allow capital to flow across borders. I would say that part of what I've talked about today is designed to try and deal with exactly that issue, because as long as you're looking at institutions and constraining institutions, then you will want, and particularly if your argument is dominated by how can we allow institutions to fail. So, you know, you need some kind of resolution structure, and individual governments want to resolve the banks in their territory. You begin to get these barriers going up. And the point about this framework is that it's a framework which any country can adopt. And if you have credit discipline within your country, the system shouldn't go up. You are building an inherently more stable system. Part of the response to the financial crisis, particularly from economists and central bankers, is, well, we didn't see it coming. We don't really know why it blew up. And, you know, we don't really know what to do to stop it going wrong. And part of the reason for that is because they simply left the banks and finance out of their models. It's a really, really simple reason. So the moment you start putting banks and finance back into the models and begin to understand how the system could work, you can begin to look at ways in which you can make the system inherently more stable. And if you do that country by country, these cross-border issues become much less important, because a country can look across at another and say, well, we've got credit discipline and China's got credit discipline, so actually the cross-border flows are going to be much more stable. But I really do fear the process of globalization, because it's not just the regulatory framework. I think there is a kind of global crisis of faith in globalization. People hate banks, I understand that. Banks are seen, you know, as being at the center of this crisis. And globalization is often seen as the manifestation of what the banks achieved, the riskiness that was put into the global financial system. And so these things are going out of fashion, but I think the impact on, well, I dare say most people here, your generation, could be very, very serious. I want my children, you know, teenagers, to have the same kind of opportunities in life as I've had. And I think we only get that if we get the financial system right.
Question here, please, from the right. Sorry, make me run again.
Thank you so much for your wonderful lecture. My name is Bob from London South Bank University. Although a little bit difficult for me to digest. My question is, as far as you know, with the first developing relationship, the Sino-UK relationship, and how soon can the customers and travelers use RMB directly in UK, in London? And by the way, I want to know, is it safe and profitable to put my money in your bank, HSBC?
I'll answer the second one first, because that's easy to answer. Yes. I mean, what is very interesting is that at the height of the financial crisis, we were seeing massive inflows of money because people saw us as a safe haven. I mean, it's ironic now when you think that people criticise banks as being too big to fail and recovering too many markets. At that time, our diversity, the fact we were in lots of different countries and you know, set across the world, was seen as a strength. And so people brought their money to us. We got to a point where we very nearly had to stop that happening. We were very close, because there's a limit to the amount of deposits you can take, because you have to put the money somewhere. When you put it somewhere, you might be losing on that, because we were under a lot of stress because there was too much money coming. So yes, the answer is, if we were safe in 07-08, I think you can pretty much count on it being safe most times. And the other thing just to mention is that actually crisis for us is completely normal. So when we went through the Asian financial crisis, we went through the Russian default, we went through certification in Argentina, we went through SARS in China, you know, we've had to build a bank which is sound on the basis that we haven't yet identified the government that would bail us out if we failed. So we can't calculate on that. Let me come back to the RMB, because I think that's a great question. You were very specific about wanting to start using RMB here. I think in terms of a kind of, as it were, a retail currency, that's going to be some time off. But in terms of its use, its arrival here, we're there already. So a year and a half ago, we issued bonds in London, in RMB. We assumed that the investors in those bonds would be largely Asian investors. 60% of them are European investors. So we had that degree of RMB liquidity from European investors in London. We're settling trade in RMB in over 50 countries around the world. To us, this is a huge opportunity, actually, not just for us as a bank, although obviously more than that, but also in terms of, coming back to your question about globalization. One of the things that you need to have in order to support a global economy is a pool of tradable liquid assets. And traditionally, those have been US dollar assets. As the US economy shrinks relative to the global economy, there won't be enough dollar assets. We need another strong currency to develop that pool of liquid assets. Clearly, at the moment, it's not going to be euro. I think the sooner that China can occupy that position, the renminbi can occupy that position, the sooner we can get back to that trend towards globalization. But we hugely welcome the whole development of the RMB as an international currency. It will take us to a more stable world, and it's something we're pushing very hard. And we hope that London will become one of the principal offshore hubs for the RMB. Thank you for the question. You can see it's something I'm a little passionate about.
You've got time? Yes, great. One question.
Hi, my name is Jason. I'm from NYU Stern. And first, I would like to thank you for your fascinating speech. I had a lot of takeaways from it. And actually, one of them is that in order to form the new financial industry in China, we should actually open up China, the financial market. And definitely, the cooperation with UK is a major step ahead. And actually, one of the recent steps that China made was to open up this derivatives market. And my question is that first, why now? And second, that do you think is there any potential problem that is posed in the Chinese financial market? Thank you.
Again, thank you. That's another really good question. The issue with China, I think, is the state of development of its capital markets. And again, one of the things that we have wanted to support and help with is the development of China's, particularly the debt capital markets. We're not at the stage yet where the growth of derivatives, the market's quite ready for that. And I think we need to move through the stabilization of the equity markets and move on to the debt markets. And then the derivatives can come behind that. The other side of that, of course, is the derivatives are about hedging, they're about financial stability, they're about smoothing price changes and so on, which are again things that China needs. So there are some challenges there because these things are moving very quickly. I do think that some of the willingness to experiment and the open-mindedness of China is very positive. Some of you have heard of the Shanghai Free Trade Zone, which I think is a really interesting experiment. Essentially, to me, what that experiment says is there are some really complicated things here that we need to try and solve. And obviously, interest rate liberalization, convertibility of the capital account are two of those complicated things, but around derivatives and derivatives trading as well. So let's just create a zone and see what happens. Now, I don't think we can ask too many questions about what the plans are, because that's the whole purpose. It's a blank sheet of paper. We want people to come in and begin to write things on this sheet of paper so that we can work out how to do this.
Okay, now I think we've got two questions, but they're going to have to be almost two-word questions, perhaps one-word answers, so let's see how we get it. First of all, this question here, gentlemen.
Thank you. My name is Joseph. I'm a Berkeley postgraduate student. Quick question. It's regarding your comment around the pegging of the U.S. dollar to the HKD. Now, my question here to work for the institution at Princeton Money, along with Barron Chartered Bank, I'm kind of wondering, with the issue that happened back in 2008, where everyone didn't know about the whole debt issue around MSB, ABS, excuse me, how does HSBC, Standard Chartered Bank, prevent itself from printing more money than it needs to without a central bank? That's just my question. Thank you.
I mean, you're talking about credit expansion,
yes,
essentially, and what constrains that.
Yes.
And that's actually the centerpiece of what I've been describing here, because theoretically, from what I was saying about credit creation, the question you ask is, well, there are two questions you ask. You go, okay, so what's the limit on that? So what constrains that? The other, I have to say, is that people say, okay, I get it now, so you lent money out of thin air and then you charge me for it. Well, that's really clever. the answer, I think, comes back to the various, I mean, there's a history here of ways in which you try and manage volume. There's a very good paper, for example, from Brookings Institution. Doug Elliott from Brookings has done a very good paper on a study of that. But essentially what it comes back to here is that if you think, you know, we're able to raise X amount of capital, if you simply adjust the leverage proportion, if you adjust the capital ratio, let's say I've got $10 of capital and it's a 10% ratio, I can create $100 of credit, but I can't do any more than that because that's what's been set by the regulator. It's like a volume control. And essentially, at heart, it comes down to a mechanism that is that simple. The question, though, is where do you make that adjustment? And that's where I feed this back into what I was saying about asset classes and identifying where asset classes are showing higher levels of risk. So, for example, we might have a risk weighting on mortgages of 20%, and then you realise that people are just lending stupidly. So you say, okay, I'm going to increase the risk weighting to 30%. That means that's where the additional capital sits. You've got more capital in the system relative to the lending level. The leverage has come down. Does that make sense?
Okay, and then we're going to finish the final question here on the right.
Thanks, Charles. My name is Xiaofei. I'm from Barclays Market Risk. My question is, biggest takeaway for me today is that the regulatory ideas should be in cooperation with the microeconomic policies, I think, if I'm right, if my sense is right. But this condition, I think, for example, the Chinese regulatory should be developed according to Chinese economy's macro policies, and the UK's economy regulation is developed based on the UK's macro policies. But given that the Chinese economy and the UK economy is still on very different development phase, Hong Kong is already a major free traded currency, but Chinese currency is still yet to be free traded. And we have seen quite a few Western banks already in China, operating in China already, but there's not much Chinese banks here in the UK. You know? My question is, what are the common frameworks would you mentioned in your talk about, you know, the Chancellor is developing, talking some common platforms between Chinese and the UK regulation works. What kind of a specific field we can work together on this part so that more Chinese banks would come here to London, you know?
Well, first of all, you'll have seen the announcement about allowing Chinese banks and wholesale banks to branch to London, which I think is a great breakthrough. And that creates a level playing field for wholesale banks in London. I think that's a positive development. But in terms of you know, what framework can we build, actually just that concept of credit discipline. I say credit discipline and it sounds blindingly obvious. It's a totally new phrase. I think we invented it. And I think to create in an economy as part of your macroeconomic framework, the notion of credit discipline and a system of credit discipline brings stability to your financial system. Where previously, economists and central bankers didn't even look at the financial system. It didn't matter. And if you go back to the years running up to the crisis in this country, the former governor of the Bank of England ran down the financial stability section of the Bank of England to just a few people, and if that's where you worked, you had no career future. It was like the financial system simply wasn't important. And that perception of the financial system even persists in places like the IMF. So economists like Olivier Blanchard, up until very recently, were describing the financial system as the fake system, it's irrelevant. So I think simply that idea of saying, A, it's important because we have no issues, but B, how do you manage it? You do it through a system of credit discipline. I think that's where we could work together. And the basic framework, I think, works for any economy, but that's an opportunity to explore different approaches to credit discipline within the Chinese context and within the UK context, and to share ideas that some of which may translate and some of which may not.
Okay, we are going to have to draw it to a close. I'd like to thank everybody to coming to actually a later event than we normally have due to time chain restrictions. I'm taking away a lot. I'm a linguist. And what fascinates me is seeing how the language of finance may develop. And what I'll just ask you one final question. Is there a new vocabulary developing? You mentioned very much of new ways of thinking, new ways of acting, new ways of behaving. But often what I notice is like old vocabulary as well. To what extent does the actual language of banking have to change in order to either reflect the change of the content or indeed to help stimulate the change?
Again, I think that's a really good question. I was very conscious actually as I spoke that I was making a mistake of falling into kind of closed vocabulary, and I thought, I need to look at this speech again actually. I mean, I reproduced what I'd said at Tsinghua, but I'd realised that a lot of that was quite specialist vocabulary. I go back to Reginald McKenna, who was passionate about this. He used to travel the country, really keen to explain to people what banks do and how finance work. And he used beautifully simple vocabulary. And I quoted a couple of his statements there, and I think both of them were pretty transparent. I think you're right, and I've sensed that tonight. We need to stop retreating into a kind of closed vocabulary. We need to find a common language that people can understand, and understand the role of banks in the economy, the role of banks in globalisation. A shared vocabulary, which at the moment we don't have. So I think that's an important part of the report.
Who knows, half the time it might be coming from Mandarin as well. So yes. Interesting that the influence of languages. Look, thank you very much again. You're a great audience. And I'd also like to thank Dr. Hong Lu, the coordinator of Civil, and the team for bringing things together. Are there things going on in the secret place that is not secret if I reveal it? If you have time for a quick drink, the Confucian Institute for Business, which is located opposite the Peacock Theatre, would be delighted to receive you. And a final round of applause to Charles Harper.